Sai.
Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Loving Sairam and greetings from Prashanthi Nilayam. Slowly, I have at last worn my way to the end of the twin series that I have been offering for about 6 months or so now on awareness on the one hand and on the Gita on the other. In this, the concluding talk, I wish to reflect on the series as a whole. I would like to begin by focusing on the word educare that I am sure all of you are familiar with. Many seem to think that educare is something solely connected with education, schools and Bal Vikas programs maybe. Not quite true. Actually, educare is a must for every person, and indeed we all must from time to time get booster shots in educare. As we all know, the world today is full of problems. Some try to avoid problems by hiding in a bubble. Others try to escape via pleasures or extreme measures like alcohol, drugs, and even suicide maybe. All this will simply not make the problems go away. On the other hand, as the population of the world keeps on increasing, people would, if current tendencies are not checked, tend to become more and more selfish as well as self-centered. In turn, this would make the problems grow, making the current situation even more intolerable. As Alan Greenspan, former head of the Federal Reserve in America, a hard-nosed banker if ever there was one, said, "You cannot live on an island of prosperity in the midst of an ocean of misery." What it means is that we simply cannot duck the problems or sweep them under the rug. Whether we like it or not, we had better learn to stand up, face the problems and find solutions. The problems humanity faces today are of an entirely different magnitude as compared to what it faced, say, 100 or even 50 years ago. If any proof is needed, just look at terrorism and global warming. It is true that right now fewer people are dying due to terrorism than compared to, say, malaria or tuberculosis. But the massive increase of poverty is very much at the root of growth of tuberculosis as well as terrorism. And when terrorism strikes, it disrupts life in a very substantial way, as we all know. As for poverty, it too can contribute heavily to global warming, even as unchecked and astronomical consumerism would. Does this mean that the end is near and that there is nothing much we can do about it except to pray and wait for the collapse? Certainly not. Where there is life, there is hope. And with Swami around, there is much more than mere hope. We actually have a way out. It is to call attention to that escape route that I prepared and offered this twin series, which I am wrapping up with this talk. Thus far, humanity has evolved through many ages such as the Stone Age, the Bronze Age, etc., etc. And in the process, humanity has passed through both progress as well as crisis. Today, we are at a crossroad, and the question is, what lies ahead? Is it despair and disaster, or hope and salvation? My answer to that question is that since Swami has come specifically to help humanity, all we have to do is to respond to his call. If we do that, then where is the question of disaster? This precisely is where educare comes into the picture. As I mentioned earlier, educare is not something just for Bal Vikas kids. All of us need something more than mere worldly knowledge and worldly skills. We need balance, spiritual balance that is, which comes from spiritual discrimination or buddhi. People often confuse buddhi with worldly knowledge. This is wrong. People may be very intelligent, but when it comes to spiritual discrimination, they could be pretty dumb. That this is very much possible has been pointed out by Krishna in the very second chapter of the Gita. I am referring to the sloka that I quoted in an earlier talk, wherein Krishna details step by step how a man goes down the slippery slope to disaster by letting buddhi become blunted. So in a nutshell, if you want to have buddhi sharp, then we better take recourse to educare. Let me amplify all this. Yes, today man is damn smart. In fact, even kids are smart, much smarter than kids used to be, say, 50 years ago. Yes, in terms of scientific and technological progress, what man has achieved during the last 50 years or so is absolutely mind-boggling. But during precisely the same period, values also have crashed and in fact almost disappeared, which is why we are faced with so many problems today. You see, the point I am making is that we must not confuse between Medha Shakti or creative worldly intelligence and buddhi or spiritual intelligence. Medha Shakti is what has enabled man to split the atom, reach out for the stars and unravel the DNA. It is the lower mind at its best. But while Medha Shakti is good at unleashing powerful creative forces, it is also very good at upsetting balance. And once balance is upset, Medha Shakti becomes almost impotent when it comes to restoring that balance. In other words, while the head is good at creating problems in plenty, it is awfully poor in finding solutions for them. I am not making this up. Just look at what has been happening all these years. Around the 80s of the 20th century, a group of experts called the Club of Rome warned, "Humanity, beware. You are consuming non-renewable resources too fast. Right now it may help the economy to skyrocket, but you are in for trouble. Pretty soon these resources like oil, for example, would simply dry up. And then you would be in the soup." Few took this warning seriously, and the world, driven by markets, went on merrily consuming more and more. Meanwhile, pollution has increased enormously, and so has economic inequality between the haves and the have-nots. In turn, this has caused global instability, leading to conflicts of all sorts and even wars. And as if all this is not enough, global warming, which the wise always knew was around the corner, has popped up, taking most people by surprise. Suddenly, everyone is talking of climate change, global warming, and expressing concern and whatnot. Yes, these days all these issues are making headline news. There are any number of talk shows on radio and TV, any number of conferences and workshops devoted to the subject, and plenty of documentaries, TV programs, etc., etc., directing our attention to these issues. In fact, starting with the year 2000, the world leaders have been busy meeting in all sorts of places under all sorts of banners to discuss the issues and the problems facing humanity. It all started with the Millennium Meeting in New York in 2000. Then there was the Kyoto Conference on Emission Controls, after which came the World Water Forums one after another. Then there were the G8 meetings and what have you. But are we closer to any real solution? I wonder. Does it mean that the situation is too far gone and that the problems are insoluble? Not really. But the problems cannot be solved using the head alone. You do not have to take my word for it. Just consider the REIT lectures delivered recently by Professor Sachs of Columbia University. I made extensive references to it in one of my earlier talks, and I need to return to it again briefly. Professor Sachs says that we face three big problems. One, threat of extensive and intensive conflicts and maybe even war. Two, catastrophe due to global warming. Three, massive problems created by massive poverty. In his lectures, Professor Sachs gives a masterly analysis of how these problems have erupted. But when it comes to solutions, I'm afraid he begins to falter. Somehow, he seems to think that technology can solve problems and that all we need is a change of mindset that would enable us to cooperate and spend money wisely on problem solving rather than on armaments, for example. He seems to feel that when mankind feels threatened enough, it would be scared into cooperating. I'm afraid that is simply not going to happen. I believe we need to go back to the drawing board, as they say, and work out an entirely new approach. Actually, we do not have to do that because Swami has already given us a detailed master plan. All we have to do is to understand it properly and start taking steps to implement it. I'm sure I've got you utterly confused and puzzled, and so maybe I should take you through the argument slowly. For this purpose, I would like to start with Swami's statement that the outside is a mere reflection of the inside. Today, we find many huge problems in the world. Where from did they all originate? From inside, from the mind of man, mind that roams restlessly and unchecked, driven by Medha Shakti. Take armaments for example. Do you know that the current military budget of the world, that is to say all the countries put together, is around $1 trillion? Do you know that? $1 trillion, that's really a huge amount. Why on earth do we have to spend so much on armaments and defense? Experts and defense analysts would say, don't be stupid, haven't you heard of terrorism, 9-11, etc., etc.? How can we protect ourselves without spending? Are you living in the Stone Age? Be practical, man. That's what the experts would say. But do you know how hollow this argument is? Professor Sachs himself points out, he says that if he were given $1 billion for a period of 5 years, repeat that, 5 years, then he, Professor Sachs, would be able to save 1 million kids in Africa from dying due to malaria. Now, how is Professor Sachs going to do this? By providing the kids in Africa with mosquito nets. Incidentally, mosquito nets do help in curbing malaria. But the problem is it costs money, and the poor in Africa simply cannot afford to buy such nets. So, many NGOs try to help. And by the way, the SAI organization in Kenya has done very good work in this area. However, all this is just scratching the surface, and something massive needs to be done, which Professor Sachs says he can do if he is given a grant of $1 billion for a period of 5 years. $1 billion, that's an awfully large sum of money, is it not? Professor Sachs says, yes, it is, but look at how many lives should be saved. But argue pundits, $1 billion, where are we going to get that kind of money? Professor Sachs replies, you want to know? I will tell you. The United States spends $1 billion per day, just on defense. Give me that money, which is spent in one single day, and I shall use it for 5 years and save 1 million lives. The argument is very powerful and most compelling. Yet, do you think anyone would lift a little finger to curb military expenditure and divert that money, even a bit of it, for humanitarian causes? I doubt it. If you look carefully, it's not just governments, but corporations and even individuals who squander money recklessly on gambling, on pleasure-seeking and whatnot. Just look at the luxury industry, the porno industry and so on. It's appalling how much money is spent. Meanwhile, the spending goes on, even as problems mount and suffering is increasing at an alarming rate. Yes, my dear listener, Medha Shakti turns itself off when it comes to solving humanitarian problems, which means that we must turn to something beyond mere Medha Shakti. And that precisely where all professors, think tank experts, bureaucrats, politicians, world leaders and statesmen woefully falter. They do not know how to go beyond Medha Shakti. Well, what is it that lies beyond the mind, the source or the fountainhead of Medha Shakti? The heart, of course. And to connect to the heart, we need Buddhi. If you recall, this is almost one of the very first things that Krishna tells Arjuna in chapter 2. Believe me, the heart can solve problems. But who is paying attention to that possibility? Instead, people simply murmur, "Oh yeah, I've heard that." Listen, that is simply not practical in this Kali age. Let us be realistic. Finding solutions based on the heart is impractical. Dear listener, are Swami's drinking water projects mere Hollywood fantasies? Are they not real? Are Sai Baba's hospital mere dream objects? Are they not real? When all this is pointed out, people say in a tired voice, "Hey, listen, will you never learn that Sai Baba is special?" Yes, the form of Swami, that beautiful and enchanting form that is so captivating and casts a magic spell on all of us, that form is indeed special. At the same time, has not Swami told us that love that He is manifesting all the time, is also latent in us? All we have to do is to make patent what is already latent in us, but we are reluctant to do that. That is the real problem. Now, why are we so reluctant? Because if we admit that there is a solution and we have to implement it, then we have to make sacrifices. Who wants to do that? So we rubbish the solutions. That is the problem. In other words, the problem is not the difficulties facing us, but our own spiritual lethargy that prevents us from giving Swami solutions a try. Okay. How exactly does Swami want us to tackle these problems? That is what I have been trying to explain during this entire series of lectures on awareness on the one hand and on the Gita on the other. Together, they add up to just this. If we treat these problems as secular problems and try to deal with them in a purely clinical way, then we are simply wasting our time. If, on the other hand, we are really serious about finding solutions, then we cannot duck the moral dimension of human existence any longer. The point is simply this. In recent times, we have quietly put morality on the back burner and conveniently forgotten all about it. Sure enough, problems erupted, and to ignore morality any longer would be at our own peril. And that, by the way, is where a blend of action with spirituality comes into the picture. And that also is what makes EduCare so relevant and pertinent to all of us. Before I dwell further, I would like to go back to Professor Sachs, if I may, because I want you to appreciate his concern and his way of dealing with current problems. Drawing attention to the gravity of current problems, Professor Sachs says, and I quote, "Our challenge, our generation's unique challenge, is learning to live peacefully and sustainably in an extraordinarily crowded world. Our planet is crowded to an unprecedented degree. It's bursting at the seams. This is the greatest challenge, learning to live in a crowded and interconnected world that is creating unprecedented pressures on human society and on the physical environment." End of quote. Professor Sachs not only details the problems, but drawing inspiration from late President Kennedy, he also offers his solutions. As far back as 1963 or so, when the world was facing a nuclear holocaust, thanks to the Cold War and the eyeball-to-eyeball confrontation between America and the erstwhile Soviet Union, Jack Kennedy, in a stirring address, said, and I quote, "First, examine our attitude to peace itself. Too many of us think it's impossible, too many think it's unreal, but that's a dangerous and defeatist belief. It leads to the conclusion that war is inevitable, that mankind is doomed, that we are gripped by forces we cannot control. We need not accept that view. Our problems are man-made, and therefore they can be solved by man, and man can be as big as he wants. No problem of human destiny is beyond human beings. Man's reason and spirit have often solved the seemingly unsolvable, and we believe they can do it again." End of quote. Kennedy had every reason to worry, especially about mass nuclear destruction. Both America and the Soviet Union at that time had thousands of deadly nuclear weapons and were almost on the brink of nuclear war at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis. I remember those days very well, and even now it sends a chill down my spine. The visionary leader that he was, Kennedy reflected a lot and came to the conclusion that man must snap out of his war psychosis and give peace a real chance. It is that conviction that made him give the speech from his Professor Sachs course. It is that conviction of Kennedy that also makes Professor Sachs feel that there is still hope for mankind. Having said all that, I must express reservations about the roadmap to peace and goodwill that Professor Sachs prescribes. I shall not go into the details, but this much I shall say. His optimism that man will wake up to the dangers and learn to cooperate seems to me like a bit of daydreaming. My own view is that except in extreme situations, humans tend to feel that they will not be affected while others might be. This is nothing new. In fact, in the Mahabharata, there is a famous incident in which Yudhishthira is asked a series of questions by an astral voice. One of the questions put to Yudhishthira is, "What was the greatest wonder of the world?" Yudhishthira replies, "People believing they would be untouched by death, even when they see people dying every day." This, according to Yudhishthira, was the greatest wonder of the world. I am of the opinion that humans should take up the challenges mentioned by Professor Sachs, and they are real challenges, let me add, driven not by fear, but by more fundamental considerations. And that exactly is where the cosmic aspect of man's existence assumes importance. If you recall, I had mentioned 4 points earlier in this connection. They are, 1, the cosmic origin of man, 2, his cosmic connections, 3, his cosmic responsibilities, and 4, his cosmic destiny. Man must rise to the occasion not merely because he is likely to be choked by excessive carbon dioxide or drowned by the oceans. Rather, he must say, enough is enough. I must stop behaving in an irresponsible way driven by lower instincts and tendencies. I must instead realize that I am a spark of the divine, and as such, I must not do anything to disturb society or harm nature. That is where the cosmic issues become important, as also man's obligations to society as well as his indebtedness to nature and its creator. If humans take seriously the fact that they are indeed sparks of the divine, something that Krishna asserts and something that Swami repeats ad nauseam, then humans would immediately stop doing many of the things they are now doing. Take, for example, the disease of excessive consumerism. Why do people have the urge to constantly buy things they really do not need? Half the time, it is simply to keep up with the Joneses, as the saying goes. But look what that is doing at the present time. If we want to change mobile phones, just because others have switched to a newer and more fancy model, then, as is already happening, millions of mobile phones get discarded every year, generating a lot of e-waste. This e-waste is quite harmful to the environment, containing as it does a lot of lead, mercury, beryllium and cadmium, among other things. If one looks at the list of hazardous material generated by waste, it is really frightening. Few in the Western world know that most of the deadly stuff in the shape of old and junk ships end up in the third world, spreading hazardous material all over the place. In fact, even poisonous garbage gets quietly shipped to poor and unsuspecting countries in some guise or the other. Don't think I am making all this up. We have had, some time ago, the case of a French aircraft carrier that had been junked and then sent to India for dismantling. This junked aircraft carrier had a lot of asbestos, an environmentally dangerous material. This old ship was to be dismantled in India on the west coast by illiterate labor with little or no protection. Luckily, some green-minded people raised a lot of noise, and our Supreme Court came down heavily on the deal and had the ship sent back. However, this is an exception. The point is that consumerism not only generates a lot of waste that is totally avoidable, but also involves a huge energy consumption associated with the manufacture, the marketing, and the utilization of the product. For example, cell phones use batteries, but then batteries have to be charged. The phones that are coming out these days have so many features, they make very heavy use of the batteries, which therefore have to be charged frequently. Now, that battery charging costs energy, and please remember that the process of generating that huge amount of energy causes its own environmental havoc. Video games provide another example of a product that is not only wasteful as far as energy is concerned, but has other undesirable side effects also. When they first appeared, only kids were obsessed with video games, but now even adults have become addicted. What is even worse, many of these games are exceedingly violent in content, and when a large number of people constantly play such games, they subconsciously develop violent tendencies. In turn, all this produces a military mindset in a large section of the population with disastrous consequences of their own in terms of conflicts that are entirely avoidable. Let me return again to the current military expenditure, which is $1 trillion per year. The big question is, do we really need to spend that much money for defense? People may cite terrorism as an excuse for this expenditure. I am aware of terrorism. In this country, we have had to face terrorist attacks for a much longer time than Western countries have had to. Now, when we discuss defense budget, protection against terrorists, etc., we have to be clear about protection on the one hand and an understanding of how the virus of terrorism has taken root. My point is simply this. Till, say, 1975 or so, no one talked of terrorism, but now it seems to be affecting people in many countries. The question is, where did this terrorism suddenly come from? It's easy to give superficial answers, but one thing scholars have agreed upon. In almost all places where terrorism has erupted in one form or the other, there has been a lot of unemployment and poverty. Which is why a bishop in Honduras said, with much wisdom I should add, poverty is the greatest weapon of mass destruction. Going back to the hospital issue, people say there is no money to fight poverty. There is no money to provide health care to the poor, and so on. Is this really true? I believe it is not money that is scarce, but love. Poverty of love is our real problem. Conflict arises whenever there is a poverty of love. In 1947, British India was divided, and two independent countries, namely India and Pakistan, were created. I was a witness to that. The birth of two countries was accompanied by unprecedented violence, with about 1 million people being slaughtered. That's an awfully large number. Since then, there has been much tension between the two countries, India and Pakistan. And yet, lately, people in the two countries have become fed up with tension. And amazingly, there's a lot of goodwill between the people of the two nations. My point is simply this. Love has been hijacked and replaced by hate by vested interests. If this hijack is prevented, many of our current problems can and will get solved. When A and B hate each other, they both try through their actions, they both try to plant hate in the heart of the other. When they succeed, then hate gets perpetuated. Hate can never be quenched by hate. And similarly, violence can never quell violence. It would only generate more violence in some form or the other. This is well known. It has been known for ages. Yet, people go the same wrong way. Why? Krishna has given the answer to that in chapter 2, and I have drawn pointed attention to that answer earlier. Simply put, when buddhi becomes blunted, the head begins to dominate. And when the heart is eclipsed and the head takes over, disaster is never far away. It is really as simple as that. Somehow, even when things are crystal clear and almost self-evident, people insist on persisting with foolish strategies. I think I must start winding up. There is so much I can and would like to say, but I guess I have to put it off to some other time. Meanwhile, I would like to recall a scene from a Bob Hope movie I saw about 50 years ago. The movie is called The Princess and the Pirate. And in that film, Bob is playing the role of a coward. Bob is on a ship which gets wrecked and he escapes with another sailor on a small boat. The boat is drifting across the Pacific and the two people in the boat do not know where they are headed. The following conversation then ensues. Bob says to his companion, "Hey, do you have any idea in which direction we are going?" The other guy says, "I don't know." "What do you mean you don't know? You have a compass. What's the compass telling you?" "Oh, the compass? I threw it away." "What do you mean you threw the compass away? Why on earth did you do that? Do you know what kind of trouble we are in now?" "Look, I threw the compass away because it was of no use to us." "How can you say that?" "Well, I threw the compass away because we want to go south, whereas the compass is always pointing north." "Well, that's good for a laugh, but man today is behaving something like that. He seems to say, look, the problems we are facing are socio-economic and political problems. Where does spirituality come into all this?" This is the common mistake that even pundits and very learned scholars make. What the Gita does is to first point out how flawed this argument is and how spirituality can not only solve current problems, but also prevent new ones from cropping up. In other words, the way to the solution of worldly problems is actually via the soul, the Atma, the heart, call it what you will. The Gita is the compass of life, and we cannot afford to throw it away. Please think about it. Let me stress once again that the ideas I am presenting have not been cooked up by me, not at all. By way of convincing you, I shall now quote from 3 Sai-inspired messages, which was mailed recently to our subscribers. For the benefit of those who might not be aware of it, our online magazine H2H mails every day a picture postcard with a photo of Swami and a message of his. This goes to thousands of subscribers by email. Many devotees find it a nice experience to open their mailbox and find a message straight from the Lord. Believe it or not, this service is now availed of by over 19,000 people every single day. And these people, by the way, are in countries ranging from Antarctica on the one hand to Afghanistan on the other. In case you do not receive Swami's postcard but would like to, please get in touch with H2H. You can get all the details of how to reach H2H by logging onto our Radio Sai website. Well, let me get back to my main point and let me quote for you 3 Sai-inspired messages sent worldwide recently. I shall start with a message sent on 18 June this year, just a few days ago. In this, Swami says, quote, "Suppose you want to eat a fruit. Do you want the fruit for your sake or for the sake of the fruit? You want the fruit because you wish to enjoy it. Similarly, every desire you have is for the gratification of your own self. There is something in you that drives you, and that driving force arises because you are either consciously or unconsciously seeking satisfaction for yourself. However, in all cases, it is the lower self that is involved. That is why one describes all such action as selfish. In spirituality, one must focus on the higher self. All actions must spring from the desire to satisfy this higher or the real self. That is true self-satisfaction. Action aiming at satisfying the inner self are not selfish in the worldly sense because they are far from worldly desires and petty expectations." End of quote. This quote, by the way, is from a discourse delivered by Swami on May 23, 2007 during a summer course. Please note that Swami is talking about the lower self and higher self. That's what I did, drawing inspiration from Swami. And Swami tells us that we must seek to satisfy the inner self. That is what Mama Dharma is really all about. Let me now move on to the second quote, which is from the Sai Inspires message sent on 22nd June 2007. In this, Swami says, quote, "Worldly objects change from moment to moment. How can you claim ownership over such temporary articles? Everything belongs to God. With this attitude, yes, you may experience the world. There is nothing wrong with that. But while experiencing, you must inquire, everything belongs to God. How should the property of God be used by me? Experience the world with your power of discrimination. If you use objects as you please, you could misuse God's property. Use the world to engage in constructive actions to walk the path of truth." End of quote. This quote is from a discourse delivered in May 1995 during Gaina summer course. And what's the main message of the quote? Trusteeship. See the connection between the first quote and the second quote? When a person begins to identify himself or herself with the inner self, higher self, universal self, Atma, call it what you will, then becoming a trustee of God is almost automatic. That is my point. So you see, I did not pull that idea of trusteeship from a hat. And now for my final quote. This too went out on the internet only recently, as recently as 23rd June 2007. This is what it says. Quote, "Truly speaking, it is not difficult to know what the basis of life is and what should be the goal of life. Bliss should be the goal, and one must seek it in all earnestness. The human body is temporary. The pleasure that it can give us also is fleeting. Therefore, one must seek that which is permanent, that is to say, God, or what is the same thing, bliss. It is meaningless to seek this bliss by way of instruments that are impermanent. The body can give only bodily pleasure, and the mind can at best give only mental satisfaction. But these do not represent bliss." End of quote. This quote is also from the summer course of 2000 and deals with bliss. My point is simple. Man wants to be happy, and true happiness is bliss, which is found only inside and not outside. So, first discover the higher self. Next, act like a trustee, which is the role cut out for a person who identifies himself or herself with the Atma. When these two steps are taken, automatically a person experiences bliss. A couple of points more about bliss. Firstly, when a person achieves bliss, it is never at the cost of another person. On the other hand, worldly pleasure is seldom a win-win affair. Usually one's pleasure comes at the cost of another's pleasure. The other person in fact becomes sad or miserable. For example, when a person sells alcohol to another person, the seller makes money and that's how he becomes happy. The buyer drinks the alcohol, becomes tipsy and thinks he too is happy. In the short term, it does look like a win-win situation, but in the long run, if the drinker becomes an alcoholic, he begins to pay heavily through bad health, while the vendor continues to make money. In other words, there is clearly a winner and there is clearly a loser. It is this asymmetry that forms the basis of almost all conflicts, both big and small. In short, where worldly pleasures are concerned, it is always a win-lose proposition, whereas where bliss is concerned, it is always a win-win situation, that is to say, no one loses. I think I have to definitely stop here. The last 6 months or so have been unusually busy for me. In the midst of all this exceptionally tight schedule, I have done my best to squeeze in this rather difficult twin series. I felt a compelling urge to do so because more than ever, humanity desperately needs Swami's message and teachings. I do not know about you, but as far as I am concerned, it is Swami's teachings alone that can save humanity from the crisis it faces today. The Gita and Swami's teachings are not exactly easy subjects to deal with, and to put them both in a contemporary setting is an even harder job. It is therefore more than likely that there have been slips and patches of fuzziness in my presentation. I apologize for all such shortcomings. However, even with imperfections galore, I have managed to get you to reflect deeply on today's problems and how Swami's teachings alone offer the way out. Then I would have achieved my goal. Well, dear listeners, I thank you all for your patience and being with me all along. I also appreciate the comments, both critical and appreciative, that came to me during the series. They were quite helpful, let me tell you. Expressing my deepest gratitude to Swami for the opportunity granted to me and seeking His forgiveness for my shortcomings, I bring this twin series to a close. Thanks a lot once again for listening. God bless. Jai Sai Ram.
That talk by Professor Venkatraman brings to a conclusion this twin series of musings on awareness on the one hand and the Gita on the other. This broadcast came to you from the studios of Radio Sai, where we are busy 24/7 bringing the loving message of the Lord to you wherever you may be. Please tell about our services to all those who still are unaware of Radio Sai, Heart to Heart, our Sai Inspire service, etc. You are also welcome to offer suggestions that would help us to serve you better and spread Swami's divine message of love. The more people hear the message of the Lord, the greater would be the transformation of the heart, and quicker would be the dawn of the much awaited golden age. Jai Sai Ram.
Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Stay tuned.
Thank you. రాగమా హృదయ